Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas, and Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar is joined by Dr. Teresa LaValle for a conversation about translational research. Dr. LaValle is Vice President of Translational Medicine at Coltan Pharmaceuticals. Here's Anish Chagpar.
So, Teresa, let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. So I'm a PhD in biologic sciences, and I have spent a career working in drug development and trying to use science to bring drugs to patients that are more effective.
And how exactly does that happen? I mean, I think that all of us who have ever been treated by a doctor who gives us a drug must at some point wonder, how the heck did this happen? So can you kind of walk us through that whole sequence that finally gets you the medicine at the drugstore?
Sure. It's clearly a long process, and it's a science-driven process, and starts from early laboratory work where you're identifying different ways of looking at what's driving a disease. So if you think about a car and having it go, what's the accelerator? And in the terms of, for instance, like cancer, the cell has essentially turned off the brake mechanism. And so the idea of the drug is to come in and put the brakes on and hopefully destroy the cell. And so getting a good understanding in the laboratory about what is pushing the accelerator on, and then trying to match either a chemical or an antibody-based drug to put the brakes on. And then as you go through development, it's early in the laboratory to really look at both the activity of the drug, so does it truly stop a cell from growing in the case of cancer? And then also the safety, because clearly that's equally important, that you don't have unwanted or too many side effects in a patient. And then you go through early clinical development. So model systems have limits, like all models do. And so testing it in people in early clinical trials to get a handle on the dose, the safety, and then testing it against other marketed drugs to show that you deserve a space in the market, because clearly you don't want to bring an inferior product to the patients.
So in that whole process, I mean, it seems like there would be so many steps that are difficult. What in your mind is the hardest part of getting a drug actually to the patient?
Probably the hardest part, I mean, that's a difficult question because it's such an integrated process. So the understanding of what the models are telling you and really understanding how best to treat, I think, is the hardest part. Because as we look, and from my perspective as a translational medicine person, I'm sure if you were asking someone who is involved more in manufacturing, they would talk about all the complexities of actually making a drug in enough scale to bring it to a person. But I think the thing that we've really are just starting to learn better is how to understand which patients to treat. So as we really try to select people that are suited for the treatment, so that diseases have a lot of heterogeneity to them. So lung cancer is not a single disease. And really trying to figure out what are the features to select those patients in lung cancer or breast cancer or whatever it is that's best suited for your treatment.
Yeah. You know, and the other thing that I think just in as you were explaining the whole process that would be difficult is really at fundamental levels, the whole thing rests on figuring out what's pushing on the accelerator and what could push on the brake. How do people figure that out?
And again, it's through both studying model systems in the lab, as well as, I think, studying patient samples and really looking and setting up clinical studies to answer those questions. So if you, like for cancer, we have tools that we can grow cancer cells in a test tube and look to see if we turn the growth off so that they stop growing in the dish. And then we can put them in mice where we look at the growth of a tumor in a mouse. And if we treat that animal, can we remove that tumor? And then, of course, those systems are much more simple than going into something as complex as a human. But the thing that translational medicine is really bringing to the field is that we're turning clinical studies into science-driven studies so that we ask whether or not that is a driver, the accelerator. And I think an example of that would be of to make it understandable is crizotinib, which was a recently approved drug in lung cancer. And so in the lab, people really felt that MET, a protein called MET, was the driver. And they had lots of really beautiful data in the test tubes and in the mice to show that was true. And then when they put it in humans and lung cancer and looked, the patients who did the best weren't necessarily the MET expressors, but the ALK expressors.
Hmm.
And that's a small subset of lung cancer patients, so it's about less than 10%. So you can't test it without screening for that ALK driver. And now it's a marketed drug that's really affording a lot of benefit to patients. And so that there shows you, as we take it from the lab with an idea that MET was the answer, but in the clinic, we really found in humans, ALK was the answer. So it's still a therapy that's effective, but it was only because they asked the question in the clinic.
I'm with you. And the other thing that seems important or interesting in what you just said is that there may be more than one thing pushing on an accelerator. And more than one thing that could push on the brake. And really, it may be trying to figure out in a given patient, in a given tumor, which is which.
And it, particularly in cancer, I think that is true. And it is rare that you have a single drug that can answer things for the patients. And that's why we have combination treatments. And figuring out which drugs go well together, both from a safety perspective, but also that they both turn off the accelerator and not one turn it off and one turn on. So it's complicated in that sense. But again, as I think as we keep asking questions, as we're developing things, we understand it better and are doing a better job of bringing effective therapies to patients.
Yeah. You know, the other question that I think a lot of patients have is, you know, we often talk about finding the answer to, quote, cancer across the board. Are the accelerator pedals and the brake pedals for different kinds of cancer the same, or are they different?
And the answer is yes and no. So I think if you look at the tumor cell, and maybe if we, as we're looking more and more today at developing targeted therapies, so in the example that I gave with the MET, which is now there are MET inhibitors that are coming to late stage clinical studies and really showing activity. And asking across different tumor types that are MET-expressing tumors, are they active? Not, is this a lung cancer drug? Is this a gastric cancer drug? But this is a MET drug, and where is MET present? And then another example of where it can be across different tumor types might be the immunotherapies, which are really having a phenomenal effect in really revolutionizing, I think, our expectations for what an effective therapy are, in that the immune system, so again, with the brakes and accelerators kind of example, the immune system has turned off our body's mechanisms to get rid of the cancer and made our immune cells, our T cells, which can kill the tumor cell, quiet and essentially asleep. So the brakes are on. And there are recent drugs against proteins like CTLA-4, PD-1, PD-L1 that essentially take the brakes off and allow the T cells to wake up and kill the cancer. And why that's particularly important is because then your immune system, if the cancer comes back, will clear it. So these long-term survival is really being seen, and that's being seen across a very broad range of tumors. And they're just now trying to understand, is this against essentially people with cancer, or is it a subset of people or just particular tumor types that are sensitive? So the complexity with cancer, when we talk about it, is that it's really 900 different diseases. And so depending upon the therapy, it can work broadly across different cancers or maybe more focused to a particular cancer type. I mean, so even in breast cancer, so clearly if you're going to target the estrogen receptor, that's going to be more focused towards breast cancer versus other tumor types.
You know, the interesting thing with the immunotherapies that you brought up, I think that that is so exciting now to rev up your immune system, because your immune system, much like your immune system fights off a cold or whatever else and gets rid of the virus of the cold, could potentially get rid of cancer. One question that I think people may be asking, and certainly is a question of mine, is, has anybody really looked at revving up the immune system to stop the cancer from getting there to begin with?
So are there vaccines? So clearly we have a vaccine now for cervical cancer. And people have spent decades trying to get it more broad. And I think it goes back to your initial question. There seems to be an awful lot of accelerators, an awful lot of brakes. So how do you get a vaccine that's broad enough to be able to take into account all those different approaches? So I think with time, we'll find incremental benefit for where it can sometimes be the answer, but it's not going to be the answer for all.
So tell us a little bit more about how you interface. I mean, you work at a pharmaceutical company. How does pharmaceutical companies interface with academia, interface with clinicians? I mean, how does that whole process work?
Yeah, so this is a great question, because recently, I participated in a career day at a university and was asked, you know, how do you decide between academics and industry? And what my advice to people in science was, follow your passion. So what you want, figure out what you want to do, and then figure out where best you can do it. And I don't know that there's a large distinction per se, because we cannot do our job successfully in a company setting without strong collaboration. And I think that is a key success factor. So working with academics is really important, and clinicians.
You know, Teresa, I want to pick up on how you made that choice and what the passion is that drives people in pharmaceuticals versus in academia. And we're going to do that right after we take a very short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about translational research.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from the disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, prostate cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses 3-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Teresa LaValle. And we're discussing translational research. Teresa, you, right before the break, were talking about your decision to go into industry and a talk that you gave at a recent career fair where you told science students to follow their passion. And I love that because that's what I tell all of my students as well. Tell me what it was about industry, about pharma, that attracted you that route as opposed to academe.
Yeah, and I think, from a very early age, for me, I was always interested in science, particularly with an application to medicine, and even initially considered whether to go into a medical profession or research, and found that what really interested me was what made people sick versus the direct patient care. From that aspect, what I've always looked for are ways to still have an impact on patients. And for me, industry gave that opportunity because research is such a fundamental part of that. And being able to work on studying diseases and ways to attack the diseases with the idea of getting medicines to patients. So as you go through and do clinical studies and see those tumors shrink in patients, that's a very exciting moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what my passion was, to really be able to say, we did work on a disease and was able to develop a medicine that helps someone.
So can't you do that in academia too? What's the difference? Or are they very similar?
And I think, and we were talking about right beforehand, they're very integrated in so many ways. You need that collaboration. And clearly, in an academic environment, they have a huge contribution to doing that. The actual complexity of developing a drug and the number of departments and the amount of money it takes to really bring it forward makes it difficult in an academic setting. Now, it has been done. There's clearly investigators that have discovered drugs and brought them to the clinic on their own. But to do it in a broad sense, it's much easier to do it in an industrial setting. And you still have the opportunity to do collaborations with a number of academics. And particularly, I'm currently employed at Coltan Pharmaceuticals, which is based in the Yale Medical School. Hmm. And there's a very strong collaboration. And that was one of the things that attracted me to that position, was really having such talent at Yale and the ability to collaborate with so many scientists to hopefully, between the collaboration and the partnership, be able to develop our drugs better.
So that, I think, is a beautiful marriage. You're a PhD in your own right. Do you do still the bench laboratory research, or are you more collaborating with other researchers who are kind of doing that initial, what's the break, what's the accelerator, and then you're taking it from there to move it into drug development?
And it's both. So we have lab capabilities. It's been a while since I've done lab work myself, unfortunately, in some ways. But we have a group of scientists, very talented scientists at Coltan in the lab, that are doing research activities, and then in partnership with various academics, have collaborations that are really much more geared towards specific questions, or maybe they have a technology that we don't have, or a particular focus in a disease. And another aspect of drug development that I found incredibly successful is if you can position where you do a collaboration both in the lab and in the clinic with people you would like to do your clinical trials. Mm. Because the physicians know best what their patients need and what's effective. And so really having their input and their scientific contribution on how you're developing it and how to position it before you've treated their patients I think makes a much better marriage and stronger data packages to get these drugs through.
So let's go back to the whole process of drug development. And this is something that I think is really pertinent when we think about not just drugs, but anything, you know, technologies, other things that we're trying to get from an idea, from the science, from the basics, to actually having something physically able to help other people. And I can't imagine how that would work without an industrial partner who can figure out all of the regulations and things that a drug process needs to go through in order to finally get FDA approval. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. From a drug development perspective, if you think about it, once it enters the clinic, so we'll start there as our starting point. To do that, you need to submit a package to the FDA if you're doing studies in the United States. And clearly, the FDA's real focus and mission is the safety and welfare of the people. So they're looking for both safety and efficacy, particularly in cancer, because taking a person who's very sick and giving them a treatment that has no chance of helping is also a cost to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So getting the right data packages that go into that. But then from a clinical perspective, once you get that agreement with the FDA, phase one clinical development is really about starting with low doses to really understand the safety in a human, because it's the first time you're treating a human. You want to see what the body system's effects are on how it metabolizes that drug, how the person's taking it. And as the particularly in diseased patients, they might have different processes and systems that are working differently. So in phase one, we really look for safety and biologic effects and setting our dose. The dose is really important. And that can take, you know, if you're lucky, a year. And then you go into what we call phase two, which is a refined dose or doses, one or two doses, in a defined patient population. So not just cancer patients, but head and neck cancer patient or breast cancer patient. And you treat them either as with your drug alone or in combination with another drug and look for activity reads. So really saying, do you have enough activity, a signal to invest in then a phase three study, which are hundreds of patients? Because to register a drug with the FDA, you both have to show safety and efficacy, risk benefit, as we often hear the FDA talk about. And for that, you need a couple hundred of patients. And in fact, the FDA requires 300 to 600 patients in your safety database. So that's a lot of time. And of course, to do all these clinical studies with all of these people, you need a large amount of drug. And that's probably why it's more well-suited for an industrial partner to do this, because the cost of manufacturing and the clinical trials is quite large.
So all of this is being done before you have FDA approval. So I can imagine that that process takes a long time.
It does. It can take years. And I think the focus of translational medicine is to learn early, because clearly a phase one clinical study is fairly short. And if you only advance compounds with a higher likelihood of succeeding, then you don't take as much time and money. But the other thing is by treating the right patient. So instead of putting it in hundreds of patients, so when we talked about the example of the crizotinib that's an ALK inhibitor, if it's present in less than 10% of lung cancer patients, if you did a study with 100 patients and didn't actually ask for the patients to have that ALK, you may not get a signal.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you just screen for that marker and then treat those patients, it's much smaller studies. And so I think people are very interested in translational medicine to try to get a better activity read, but also in a shorter time frame.
How long does it usually take to get a drug from phase one to actually routine, FDA approved, ready to use, off the shelf?
And clearly, there's no one answer, and it really depends upon what the disease is. So in cancer, and there are many different cancers, usually you'll see a first approval in later stage disease, which essentially what that means is the people are pretty sick. And so their life expectancy, because survival is the endpoint, is relatively short. And so, you know, it would take a couple handfuls of years, you know, so 5 to 10 years would be the norm. But we are seeing with some of these agents, such as some of the immunotherapies now that are really coming up, the PD-1 and PD-L1s, where they're going from phase one to phase three because they're seeing such good reads early, and other compounds that are going into phase one and selecting the patients up front and then go directly into the phase three. So the crizotinib story was only a couple of years.
Yeah.
So there's a broad range, but, you know, when you do an average, it's a couple handfuls.
Yeah, because I can just imagine that there are people who are listening to us who are thinking, you know, we want to find therapies for cancer in particular that are safe and that are effective, but it's no good if it's just an idea that's sitting on the shelf. We need to get this into the hands of patients, and, you know, anything we can do to accelerate that process will certainly help. So tell us a little bit more about where you think the future of cancer research is going and how we get there.
Yeah, and I think, again, that we've made amazing strides over the last few years. And one way to say what has been the largest success factor, and there's probably several different answers to that question, but the answer that I would give is that understanding of who to treat. So in just broadly, so even when we think about leukemias and lymphomas, mm-hmm. so the blood cell-based diseases, in the 1960s and 70s, that was basically just called leukemia or lymphoma. And now we have so many different subsets of that, and we're really seeing remarkable benefits in those patients. So instead of just a lymphoma, there's hundreds of lymphomas, and trying to match the treatment to go with the patient. So a recognition that cancer is heterogeneous and that you have to define that subset of people that are best suited for your treatment, even with the immunotherapies. You know, I think the CTLA-4 benefit is tremendous, but it's in 10% of patients. Mm-hmm. So how do you select those 10% up front to get that remarkable survival? PD-L1 and PD-1, it seems to be more like a third to a half, maybe. I mean, the data is still evolving, but it's not everybody. Mm-hmm. So there's no one answer in really finding that. And I think that's an exciting time because it really gets people with treatments that are apt to benefit them and don't waste their time with toxicities and treatments that aren't going to help.
Is this all the genomics part of personalized medicine?
So that's an interesting point. I think that genomics is part of it, but it's only an answer. And one of the things we really have to be careful about is asking for a single technology to give us all the answers.
Dr. Teresa LaValle is Vice President of Translational Medicine at Coltan Pharmaceuticals. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.